Hi, thanks for joining this medcast entitled Focusing in on Novel Oral Therapies for Moderate Plaque Psoriasis. I'm Lauren Miller. I'm a dermatology PA. I practice in Oxford, Alabama with Southern Skies Dermatology and Surgery. And I am joined today with my lovely co-host. I feel like we are BFF now because we've done a couple of these together, Jamie. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself.
I'm Jamie Heim, and I'm a nurse practitioner, and I work at West Michigan Dermatology.
All right. Well, today we are going to discuss really some exciting new developments in the treatment landscape of plaque psoriasis, which we know that landscape has kind of blown up over the last really decade, but really over the last couple years, we've got lots of new options from topicals to orals to injectables. So we're just going to share some insights today on some of these new novel options that we have and really just kind of talk about the burden of disease that these patients experience. So, we always have a fun guest, and today we get to have one of my most favorite people, Christine Cusera, on with us today, who is so well-versed, obviously in dermatology, but also in inflammatory skin diseases. So, hi, Christine.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So why don't you, obviously, I just gave your name, but let us all know, the audience know where you practice and kind of what your background is. How long have you been in practice? Things like that.
So I have been in practice for a short 28 years. And I love talking about inflammatory diseases, especially psoriasis, because when I started practicing, we didn't have much to use. And it's so nice to have just a plethora of options that we can give our patients now. I practice in Dallas, Texas, and I am with Bayer Dermatology. And we have two dermatologists and we have five APPs. So I'm super excited to be a part of this big practice.
Yeah, so that and that's a new adventure for you, right?
It is.
All right. Well, we have the gang together, and so we are going to get started. So let's start off by talking about wait times for patients to get in for dermatologic care. So this is something that I have spoken on many times with my past with SDPA. Christine, you're a past president as well, so I'm sure that is not new to you either. So let's talk about how long do you feel that it usually takes to get in to see a dermatologist, or really even just we could just say a dermatologic practice in general, and what is your stance on how APPs can really help with getting patients the access that they need when we talk about dermatologic care and plaque psoriasis?
So that was going to be my main point. I feel that if you have APPs in your practice, patients can get access to care much, much faster than if you just have dermatologists. And the practices here in Dallas that I know of, they're very busy. If they do not have any APPs on board, it can take months and months to get an appointment. If we do have the practices with the APPs on board, I know that patients sometimes can get in the same day or next day. So it's been a huge difference in patient access to care.
Jamie, what's your experience with that? I know you've been practicing a long time as well. So, what's your experience and have you seen a change since you started practicing until now?
Absolutely. There's been a huge shift in the paradigm. And what's been happening is that, especially with more and more APPs entering dermatology, and being educated in regards to psoriasis and the other diseases that we have with inflammatory diseases. This has really helped to ease the burdens of the practices too, because a lot of times you have cosmetics, you have surgical procedures, you have Mohs, and yet there are these large group of people that have chronic disease that need to be seen, and you need to know how to manage them. So it's really important that the APPs have stepped up and have taken on this role within those practices.
I couldn't agree more. So it's allowing patients to not only get in and be seen, but it's getting them quality care.
Yes.
And so, we as APPs pride ourselves on continuing education and continuing to learn. And so, I couldn't agree more with you. We now can kind of say that we have expert APPs in a lot of these disease states. Some that, I look to when I need help with a really tough patient. So I think that obviously having APPs allows patients to get in quicker, but I couldn't agree more that they're getting in quicker, but they're still getting that quality care that they need. So let's talk about suboptimal care. And let's talk a little bit about moderate plaque psoriasis. And Jamie, you and I talked about this in one our last session that we did, and we hit on this, and we talked about, kind of a definition of what moderate disease is. And we did talk about what's uncontrolled, what's suboptimal, because that could be different for everybody, right? So let's start talking, Christine, about, what your general approach is to kind of suboptimal control. Like, do you typically, if you think it's not as controlled as you'd like, do you bring that up to the patient, or do you wait and let them tell you that maybe they think it's not as controlled as what they would like? Talk to me about that and, what your views are on moderate plaque psoriasis and how you kind of decide what moderate is, and if you think a patient needs to be on, let's say, a topical versus a systemic.
Okay, so I am from the school of thought, and I think it's probably from all the amazing training I got in my psoriasis journey and career. And no matter whether the patient is mild, moderate, or severe, we have to remember that this is a systemic inflammatory disease. So I am someone that really sits down and educates the patient and talks to them about that. And I use the acronym sometimes of this is like having high blood pressure or diabetes. You don't put a cream on that. That's not going to control that. Creams, of course, there's places for them. Topicals, we have a lot of great new topicals out now that are for psoriasis. So there are places for those, but I do not feel like topicals only control psoriasis. And I have that conversation with my patient, and I make sure I give them tons of handouts and education. And once they understand that, then they are more apt to listening to the systemic options that I want to offer them. Once they are on a systemic therapy, I shoot for the stars. I want them to be crystal clear. And I think we have the drugs that can do it these days. So when I do see a patient back in the office, even if they're happy and I feel like it's suboptimal control, I will bring it up to them. Are you happy? I ask them, do you want me to try to make this any better? Do you want me to try to get you crystal clear? Because I'm on board if you are. So I really do talk to the patient and I see what they want. And you know, there's a lot of patients that are happy. They remember where they came from and they're happy being 75, 80, 90% clear. They're afraid. They're afraid that they're going to get back to that point. So sometimes they're afraid to change. But if the patient's happy, I'm happy. If the patient's not happy, then 100% I'm not happy. And I'm going to try to get them better results.
Yes, and I agree with you. I am on board with the systemic inflammation talk, and it might not be the first conversation that we have. I might, it might take a visit or two to get to that, but I definitely always discuss that with the patient because, like you said, you're not going to put a cream on high blood pressure. And so when we talk about this systemic inflammation that's going on with these patients, and not just that, but we know now so many comorbidities that go along with the disease. We're probably going to hit on this in some of the next sessions, but so many comorbidities, and there's data that shows and research that shows that if we use systemic options and we knock down that systemic inflammation, we can make those comorbidities better. So, couldn't agree with you more. Jamie, do you have any thoughts on this that are any different?
No, I agree with both of you. And I tell patients this is a chronic disease, and we're there treating a chronic disease. And so it's about looking also at the future for this individual, really looking at their quality of life. So like when Christine said, and you go in there and you ask him, how do you feel about this? Where are you at with this? Because it's really important what the patient feels. And, when we look at even the definition of moderate disease, so, there's several different definitions, but we have to think about the fact that if patients just have it on their scalp or their face or their genital areas or, under the arms and the breasts area, we really need to think about these and quality of life too. Not only those comorbidities, but the quality of life that goes along with it too. So, and we need to actively, the bottom line is we need to identify these patients. We need to talk to them just like Christine and educate them as well as treat them. Be active in treating them.
Yep, I agree. And Jamie, you have heard me say this multiple times. You're probably sick of hearing it, but my favorite thing and what I always ask my patients that have inflammatory diseases is, what does your disease prevent you from doing? So they get asked that at their first visit. It gets documented and they get asked that at their follow-ups. And the goal would be if they have an answer to that question and they can say, well, it prevents me from wearing certain clothes, or it prevents me from sleeping, it prevents me from, being intimate with my spouse. They have an answer. My goal is for every time I ask that, for one of those things to fall off that list until they can say, it's not preventing me from doing anything. So that kind of helps me know, okay, we've got control, and they're probably happy there. So.
What a super important question to ask your patients, because it's interesting, and we all know this, that a patient can have mild disease, but if you throw the quality of life in, then it can push them into a higher category.
And what we might think of as mild, if you don't ask a question like that or something similar, or at least probe some, we're going to assume, hey, it might not be really affecting them. I mean, they might have 1% BSA, but like Jamie said, that doesn't mean that to them that it's mild. They may be feeling something different from what we are seeing visually. So, all righty. Well, so let's talk about. We have these treatment options now that we can give to our patients. We talked about some of the newer ones, or we can mention some of the newer ones. So we've got tapinarof cream. We have roflumilast topical cream. So that's for plaque psoriasis. We have deucravacitinib now, which is an oral systemic for plaque psoriasis. And now we have bimekizumab, which is an injectable. So we have all of these new options, but what else do we all have too? We have insurance issues. And so it can get very frustrating to have these new novel therapies and want to give a patient something that we feel is best for them and really get excited and go, hey, I really think you'd be the perfect candidate for, A, B, C, whatever it might be, but we have to jump through some hoops to get you there. So, what are your experiences as far as access goes? And do you really allow that to, I guess, dissuade you from using something? Or do you always just go ahead and say, you know what, I'm going to at least try to get this covered. It's probably going to be denied, but I'm going to try it anyways. And we do have some good patient assistance programs and things like that now, but it's very frustrating. And I'm sure you guys feel the same way, just because you can't really practice medicine. It's about what the payers want to pay for, right? So, Jamie, kind of talk to me a little bit about what your thoughts are on this, because again, you've been doing this a long time, and so things have changed over the years.
They have changed over the years, and I think Christine would agree with me that it's gotten harder and harder and harder. We could go ahead and write a script back in the old days, for Intanersop, and they could get 3 months of supplies sent to them at one shipment. Now that's just unheard of. And
Yeah,
so
we were still
it
writing them on the paper, prescription pads.
We were
I know,
using
that seems like
faxes.
forever ago.
Yeah, it's using faxes to fax things over. So
Oh my gosh.
we've come a long way. But in regards to the structure with payers, it's been really restrictive. We recently, I think that too, even with requiring a DMARD as far as for bio for bi to get to biologic therapy, and then now saying for some insurers, you have to use a biosimilar second. So we've stepped back 22 years in our practice. It's really unfortunate. I'm a dragon slayer. I gotta tell you, I fight and fight and fight. And so when your patients need something, I found out exactly what they want us to do. Sometimes they want you to use things that are off label. Well, I'm requesting something that's used on label, FDA approved, and you want me to use something that's off label, that's going to be an instant no. I'm not going to use that because that is off label. That is for X. And then the other things, if it's reasonable, I will use it. And, to get my patient the access to the medication that they need. And, but, the problem is that it's just become so difficult for our staff. And for our biologic coordinators and that, it's become very time consuming. And then they want it to become very time consuming. But I think that in the end, our patients are really worth fighting for the access for them for the medications that they need. I wish it wasn't like that, but I really feel that, this is the reality of our world today.
So, and we have to be advocates for them.
Yes.
We are giving them and prescribing what we think is best for them, but now we have to actually go to fight, go to war for them, which I think we have three female bulldogs on this chat, and all three of us would probably do the same thing. So I'm not going to let an insurance company tell me what they think is best for the patient who has never seen that patient. I'm going to go ahead and write that prescription that I think is best for them, and then we will figure it out. And it is a different time now. When I first started practicing, we didn't have biologic coordinators. Now offices are having to spend money to have someone specifically doing these prior authorizations or trying to get these denials reversed and things of that nature. So it is, it's very frustrating. It's very costly. And Christine, what are your thoughts on it? I'm going to guess pretty similar to what Jamie and I have said, but
Definitely agree with what you guys have said. And, one thing that I find frustrating is you have this conversation with your patient, and together y'all decide which treatment is best. You send it in. And then if you just cannot get it for any reason and you have to change it, then it makes the patient question you. Well, why did you not talk to me about this one first? And why did we not decide on this one first? And then you have to go through that whole conversation with them. But a saving grace, I will say, has been all these bridge programs. I mean, thank goodness that the companies are letting patients get on drug right away while we're in the fight, and let them at least get some relief from their disease.
And something that I find very interesting is sometimes it's these topical therapies that we're having even more trouble with getting approved than even the systemics, which has been really interesting to me. But I'm very grateful, like you said, for having the bridge programs, but then having these starter packs too. So deucravacitinib gives you a whole month starter
Yes.
pack, and it's a newer therapy, so they know there's going to be some insurance hiccups, and so they went ahead and thought about that ahead of time, and so we can give them a month's supply to get them started on it, so patients aren't having to wait. So that's been a game changer too. But totally agree with you. They want to know okay, you told me that this is best. So why now are we going to switch? And so now you almost kind of have to have the talk in the room. I'm going to give you this. It may not be covered, so we might have to do this. It's just it can be a mess. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but I guess these are the times that we're in. So, but because we're female bulldogs, we're going to keep fighting. So we're going to send those faxes back as many times as it takes, right, Jamie?
Yep. And those patient access forms are right loaded into Emma. And every time before the patient leaves, it's like I'm signing mine and they're signing theirs and getting all that done. So, and trying to make it as efficient as possible. Because it's just become more complex.
It is. So when we, talk about topical therapies and systemics, orals versus biologics, there are so many different options on the market. And this is kind of such an open-ended question. And we could sit here and probably talk about this for an hour, honestly. And everybody probably has a little bit different way that they approach it. But I would love to hear both of your approaches to how you kind of decide whether or not you're going to do an oral therapy versus an injectable therapy. There are so many different things that you could kind of take into account. And so I know what I would do, but I would love for you guys to share with the audience what you do and how you decide what therapy you're going to give your patient. So, Christine, let's start with you and kind of talk to us a little bit about how you decide what therapy you're going to give them. Is that something that you're already thinking before you ever go in the room based on like the medical history that you see, in the chart? And then you're kind of asking some questions once you get in, or how does that go? Talk to me about that.
Absolutely. Medical history is big, comorbidities. I always take into account quality of life. If the patient is really devastated by their disease, I want something that's going to have a rapid onset of action. Also, we all have to have the conversation about can you give yourself an injection? Some people can, and some people literally cannot. I did not think there was such thing as needle phobia until I actually saw a few of my patients in a fetal position because they did not want to give themselves an injection. And I thought, okay, this exists.
Gosh.
So there's a lot of factors that go into that, but also patient preference in the fact, how old are you? Are you in college? Do you not want your roommates to know that you're having to take a tablet or an injection every single, week, every other week, every month? Do we want something that you can, hide and only do every 8 to 12 weeks or something like that? So a lot of thought goes into it.
That's a good thought. I hadn't thought about that. I had not thought about whether or not somebody might be in a position to where they're like, I don't want people to know. Yeah, that's a good one, Christine. Look at you. See, I'm learning
And
things.
yes, and I've had a college student tell me, they don't want to go on something that they have to keep in the refrigerator in the dorm because they don't want their roommates or suite mates to see it. So there's, a lot of things that come into play.
Jamie, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I guess the only other thing is looking at those patients with special considerations, like maybe patients that are women that are in childbearing years. And so and actively, hoping to get pregnant and start their family. So that is one factor that enters into that. But other than that, everything else really is pretty much exactly what Christine said. Yes.
Yeah, and talking about just that systemic inflammation, first thing that we started talking about, I'm one of those that I'm kind of early on, I'm already thinking, systemic in my mind. I think about PSA with every patient. I'm at least, I do the questionnaire, I do PSA exams. I've gotten pretty good at doing PSA exams in a quick amount of time to do just a quick assessment. So that kind of plays a role too. Some of these therapies don't quite have the indication for PSA yet. So definitely that kind of needs to come into play. But really, everything that you guys have said, I think is spot on with what I would do and points well made. So now I mentioned deucravacitinib earlier. And this is a new novel therapy. Never had anything like it on the market. And this has been something that has been much needed because before that, we really only had apremilast as kind of gold standard for systemic therapy. Methotrexate, cyclosporine, those are older things that, yes, there are people that still use them, but they've kind of started to kind of fall by the wayside a little bit as we've gotten things that are more efficacious, safer, don't require as much laboratory monitoring. But deucravacitinib, new novel therapy. It's a TYK2 inhibitor. And so I want to talk about one, TYK2 inhibitors, because this is something new. And I think everybody was a little bit surprised that it didn't get the box warning, even though it's in that JAK family. It is not a JAK inhibitor. And so I love talking about this. Because when you really break it down for somebody and explain it, and you kind of see the light bulb go off, it's all, I don't know. I geek out on it because I'm a science nerd. But Christine, let's talk about deucravacitinib and TYK2 inhibition and how you kind of explain that, let's say to a colleague, not even necessarily a patient, but let's talk about colleague and how you would differentiate that from a JAK inhibitor. How would you explain it?
Okay, first of all, it's crazy that when we talk about oral treatment, methotrexate was approved in 1972. Apremilast was approved in 2014. And then we had nothing since. Finally, 2022, we get a new tablet or oral that we can give our patients. So that was super exciting. But yes, you do have to sometimes handhold colleagues a little bit because they don't really understand the difference between a TYK2 inhibitor and a JAK inhibitor. The thing that I like to say, I try to put it simple, and I like to say TYK2 is a member of the JAK family along with JAK1, 2, and 3. So that's the little family, but it's important to remember that deucravacitinib is a TYK2 inhibitor. And it's not a JAK inhibitor. And this is unique because it's highly selective for binding and inactivating TYK2. And it has very little ability to block the other three members of the JAK family. And it's able to do this because of where it binds in the regulatory region of TYK2. So that's what I try to let them know. It is so highly selective to blocking TYK2 that it leaves everyone else alone.
So you don't get the collateral damage that you can get with some of the JAK inhibitors that,
Yes.
have some other functions within the body, Jamie, anything that you would change or say differently if you were going to describe TYK2 inhibition and the difference between that and the JAKs?
No, I really won't because that's exactly what it does. It really is very selective. So we don't have all that minutia. We don't have all that, the lipid metabolism and then also the blood dyscrasias and just multiple other baggage that comes along with it because it is so selective to TYK2. And I think that Christine did a great job explaining that.
And because it didn't get the box warning, I think that was huge. I think that the FDA did the right thing in not giving them the boxed warning. But let's take that off the table when we talk about safety, because that would go into safety. There are obviously some, side effects. And so anytime a new therapy comes out, that's one of the first things we want to know, is it efficacious and is it safe? And so let's talk about the safety profile of deucravacitinib. And tolerability is a big thing too. They did go head to head against apremilast in their trials, and they were more tolerable and had fewer adverse events when we talk about diarrhea, nausea, headaches, which are things that we see with apremilast in a little bit higher rates. So, Christine, Let's talk about the safety profile for deucravacitinib. What things do people need to know if they think they want to prescribe deucravacitinib? Are there any labs that need to be done before they can start? Are there any labs that need to be done while they're on therapy? What kinds of things do they need to be monitoring for, or things that they might need to be concerned with? Let's talk there. I know that's a lot.
Okay, so one thing I love to talk to colleagues about, and Jamie has probably experienced this as well, but when you do clinical trials, a patient will be very quick to drop out if they cannot tolerate a medication, even if it's working. If it's working and they are not tolerating it or they're having adverse events, they will peace out very quickly. So what I like to look at is in these clinical trials that they did on deucravacitinib, when they put it up against apremilast and a placebo, there was very, very low discontinuation rate from adverse events. And deucravacitinib was actually even lower than placebo. So that tells me a lot. That tells me that patients are doing well, but they're also tolerating and they're not having any problems on the medication. Like, that's huge to me. So that's
Yep,
one
you're
thing that
exactly
I
right.
like. Yeah, the one thing I like to talk about. And then the other thing is just to remember that because it selectively binds to TYK2 and it leaves JAK alone and we don't get that collateral damage, we're not getting all the crazy adverse events that we get with a JAK inhibitor. And the clinical trials are there. We have short term, we have long term data now. I believe we have up to 3 years now. And in all that data, the data has been consistent with no increases in adverse events and no new safety signals along the way. And I always tell colleagues and even patients when you're looking at something long term, you don't want more adverse events or problems creeping up the longer you're on medication. And for something to have no new safety signals popping up along the way after having several years of data is a super positive. And so that's one thing that I like to focus on as well. And then with the looking at the clinical trials, you know, there were slight increases in a few things versus placebo, but they remained very, very low. And these things are like upper respiratory infections, herpes simplex infections, mouth ulcers, folliculitis, acne, but still remained very, very low. And then looking longer term into the specific adverse events that we look at in systemic therapies, such as like skin cancer, VTEs, MACE, they were all very low and similar to placebo at week 52 and continued to remain low or even decrease with time. So, again, no new safety signals. We're seeing any adverse events at all are low, and they're actually getting lower as time goes on, which is what we would like to see.
Bravo. Okay. That was an amazing answer. And I could literally, the whole time you were talking, I was thinking, this is how she talks to patients and how efficient you are and how easy you are to understand. So that was perfect. Jamie, let's talk because this is something you and I talked about on a previous session when we talked about, I believe it was deucravacitinib, and we talked about there is a little bit of a difference because there really isn't much that's required in order for you to start on drug. So what things do you have your patients do before you start therapy? And are there anything that you would have them do while they're on therapy to monitor?
Well, the one thing that is required is the TB test. And then that is one thing that remains that requirement for this medication. And just because, and I would like to speak personally, that just because of the fact that in the literature and that you realize that the medication, you know, is out and we use it. But, when do we really feel comfortable with the medication? How many times do we prescribe it? Do we feel comfortable? And so just because of, looking at any increase in liver enzymes, so I normally go ahead and I will do my baseline labs the way that I normally do them. Because for whatever reason, or if I have to take and may possibly change the patient down the way, I know that I already have my hepatitis screen is done, my TB test is done, I have my CBC, my CMP, and for this, I also do a fasting lipid, because if something happens later on, or if a patient goes to their primary care, and we know that for patients with psoriasis, one of the comorbidities is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and they say, oh, you know what? This your liver enzymes are up. This is because of this medication. Well, how many times do we have patients come in, or patients will ask pharmacists at the window, and they're like, "Oh yeah, it's because of that." And you're like, huh, we don't have a leg to stand on. So I always like to dot my I's, cross my T's, and I think it is APPs. We have to do that. And I really feel strongly about that. And as well as looking at those patients' comorbidities with cardiovascular disease and that, I do. I want to know what's going on with their HDLs or LDLs or triglycerides and their cholesterol. And I do. And so it's not a requirement. But I think that it's something that is a good practice to have. So it's not going to stop me from prescribing the medication at all. But I think that as personally, as a prescriber and an APP, I really like to cover those bases for my patients.
Yeah, I agree. I do the same thing. I often, because we're in a rural area, we have a lot of patients that just do not go to primary care doctors. The only time they will go to a doctor is if they just absolutely have to. So I feel better going ahead and having them draw everything. And if I see something that's off, then I can be their advocate and say, hey, did you know? No, you didn't know, but now we need to send you over to, somebody because of this or this. And I agree with you too. If we need to change therapies down the road, then we've already got everything that we need. We don't have to, bring them back up to do their labs. We can kind of do some of that paperwork over the, just they're at home, we're at the office, we do the paperwork, and we can have things shipped and started. And so it's just easier. But I think the guidelines now, they're recommending that we monitor lipids and things like this. It's just normal day care. I think it's something good to do. Do you have to do it for deucravacitinib? You do not, unless, of course, there's a reason for you to, because they're high risk. And that's something that's different because apremilast, you don't have to check for TB. There's no blood lab work monitoring required for apremilast. And so, obviously, there's some differences there that might make a difference in whether or not somebody prescribes one versus the other. But it's always good to see. The FDA really give something a great safety kind of stamp of approval and say, hey, this is the only thing that you have to do because we didn't see any kind of crazy safety signals. So, all right, you guys, we talked a good bit, talked a lot about just being advocates for our patients. And we talked about deucravacitinib and some of the new novel systemic options that we have. And so, Christine, thank you so much for coming and talking with us and sharing your knowledge. I've known you for years. You're somebody that I look up to because of your expertise, and I would definitely consider you an expert along with Jamie in inflammatory skin diseases. So it's always a pleasure to hear from you. And like I said, I learned something from you, a new little trick that I need to start thinking of. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was great talking to you guys.
It's wonderful talking to you too.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing in this informative discussion about plaque psoriasis, some new novel treatments, and how we can be advocates for our patients. If you enjoyed the content, subscribe to the e-newsletter, and you can receive upcoming Medcast episodes and other great content in your inbox. So, till next time.